Today on Against the Grain, evidence shows that the more curious we are, the better we learn and the happier we feel. And yet much of our schooling discourages curiosity, and our curiosity shrinks with time for complex reasons. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with developmental psychologist Susan Engel about what drives and inhibits curiosity. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Curiosity is a universal impulse. But what isn't universal is how curious we remain as we go from ravenously inquisitive infants and small children to adolescence and adulthood. And yet, curiosity is fundamental to how much we learn and how happy we are. Developmental psychologist Susan Engel turned her attention to the question of curiosity, which up to very recently has been a neglected field of study. In The Hungry Mind, The Origins of Curiosity in Childhood, which was 10 years in the making and was published by Harvard University Press 2 years ago, she explored what fuels curiosity and what diminishes the drive to understand the world. Engel teaches in the Department of Psychology at Williams College and is the author of many books. Susan, it's good to have you back. Obviously, infants and toddlers are enormously curious about the world. They're impelled to explore everything that they can. How does curiosity appear to diminish during life?
Well, I think it both appears to diminish and to some extent does diminish. I don't think that's all just appearance. Let me say that to begin with. So, babies are born with this enormously powerful tool, which is their ability to detect novelty. And at the same time, I mean, that implies, and in fact it is, an equal capacity for identifying patterns, whatever is the same as or familiar to whatever they've experienced. So, you know, they recognize their mother or primary caregiver's voice almost immediately and his or her face, and they quickly sort of have a scheme for that, a schema. Then they notice when the voice is different or when they hear a new voice or when they see a different face. And that ability to both identify patterns and recognize what's familiar and be particularly interested in what's unfamiliar is the mechanism that powers this enormous amount of learning that happens in the first few years of life, because they're quickly getting these schemas or scripts or whatever you want to call them, these sort of frameworks that guide them through the day and tell them, you know this, you know this. Oh, yes, that's a face. Oh, yes, that's an animal. Oh, that's breakfast. Oh, this is what happens at breakfast. What they do is if something unusual happens, so suddenly instead of eggs, you put a big piece of chocolate cake on their high chair, you know, or someone they've never seen walks in the door, they do what any really good investigator does. They stop, they look for a long time. They show all these sort of quote-unquote symptoms of interest and attention. Their breathing changes, the moisture on their skin changes. They're attentive. And why are they attentive? They're trying to figure out whatever's unknown, which is an incredibly adaptive mechanism because it means you're learning the world around you all the time. That's only part one of my answer, which is that explains the kind of omnivorous, ubiquitous, devouring hunger for new information that little kids seem to show. And so psychologists think that there's an inevitable diminishing of that because less and less of everyday life is filled with surprise. You know, after a while, you sort of know what people look like and what animals are and what trucks do and the different routes to daycare, for instance. So daily life becomes a little more predictable and familiar, and you're not in a, you know, that, you know, babies seem like they're in a constant state of surprise. Well, they are. There's so much to absorb and study. As you get older, you don't have to study everything all the time because lots of it is familiar to you. So in that sense, curiosity diminishes because there's just not so much to be learned all the time, every day. At the same time, as we get older, we also develop interests. So even by the age of 2 or 3, one kid can't get enough of mud puddles, and another kid can't get enough of dinosaurs or, you know, bugs or trucks or any number of things. Might be something more unusual, like music, sounds. As they get these specific interests, they sort of hone their curiosity antenna in on these specific domains. So curiosity gets a little less omnivorous and all-pervasive, and it gets a little narrower and deeper. That explains the kind of overall, if not diminishing, kind of narrowing and definition of curiosity. And, you know, by the time we're older, by the time you're 8 or 10 or even grown-ups, not everybody's curious about everything. I mean, nobody's curious about everything.
Sure.
That said, it's also the case that some ways in which curiosity seems to diminish in the first, let's say, 8 years of life seems to be less inevitable, less a part of the sort of developing organism, and more having to do with how various kinds of exploration are responded to by adults, you know, more by the environment.
Right. So on the one hand, there is a trajectory that you're saying we all follow, which is just as the world becomes more familiar to us, we're not probing every single thing.
Exactly.
On the other hand, there's something that might be more social and may vary from person to person depending on their experience. So focusing on that second part, what sort of things appear to affect curiosity as children move, especially through the elementary school years?
Yeah. So there are a couple of things, and some of them actually sort of predate school per se. So there's an increasing body of work showing that actually a sense of security is very important to exploration. So kids who feel secure, and the original sort of like paradigm for that is secure attachment. Kids who feel confidently attached to a caregiver, we know, are much more likely to explore their environment. And actually, some research shows that kids who have a secure sense of connection or attachment to a caregiver at two, actually, when brought into a lab at age four and offered a chance to explore a novel toy or an object, they approach the object more quickly and they explore it more thoroughly, suggesting that actually that early sense of security sort of, you know, has a long-term impact on children's curiosity or exploration. So that's one thing. I mean, I have come to think, and we could talk about this more later if you want, that actually as kids get older, it's not just the original primary attachment security that matters, but a sense of security in any given environment. And I think that's really important for thinking about school, because kids who are scared all the time at school, whether it's being scared of the overall place or the neighborhood or even of their teacher, are just less likely to explore. When people are too nervous, when people are too inhibited by fear, they feel less curious. So that's one environmental feature that both predates school in one way, but also might be sort of, there might be a version of it that actually unfolds in school. And children are very sort of susceptible to the feedback and response or sense of permission they get from adults when they're exploring. So kids who come into a room with an interesting object they've never seen before explore it much less frequently or less thoroughly or less avidly when there's an adult sort of making frowning faces or saying things like, ooh, be careful. And they're equally susceptible to the adult who smiles or says, oh, you're interested in that, aren't you? Or, oh, what's in there? So even the most casual responses, negative or positive, seem to encourage or discourage children's exploration. Those are just some examples.
Well, I want to talk more with you about these sort of different forces, either encouraging curiosity or limiting it. But
Perhaps
this is the time for a really banal question, which is, why does curiosity matter intellectually or emotionally? Why is it something that we should care about?
God, it's not actually a banal question at all. It's one that keeps cropping up amongst scholars. Because early on, when I was writing my book on curiosity, I felt I had to make this really strong case to educators that the reason curiosity was important is because it is the single most powerful fuel for learning. And, you know, I'm glad to describe studies if you want, but let's just start off by saying that there's a huge amount of research that shows that when you're curious about something, you learn about it. And actually, when you're curious about something and you learn it, you're far more likely to remember it over time. So if you could put various features of the educational environment into little capsules or vitamins, and then you had to pick only one to take that would make you a good learner, this would be the one. I mean, it's a way more powerful fuel for learning than the motivation to achieve, actually, which is the one that gets a lot of play these days in educational settings. You know, if you want to do well, if you want to go to high school, or you want to get into college or whatever it is, you'll work hard, you'll concentrate, you'll be self-disciplined, and then you'll do well. And that's true, but purely from an intellectual perspective, what's the thing, the experience that makes you actually absorb new information? It's being curious about it. So I used to feel that I had to convince, you know, teachers or education policy people that this was why they should value curiosity, because it led to learning. And I assumed that was their main goal, to get kids to learn, so they would embrace the value of curiosity if they thought it led to a child's ability to take in and retain information. But it was actually a reviewer of my book, an anonymous reviewer, when I was going through that process, another scholar, who said, why do you have to pin it all on the learning it leads to? It's such a wonderful and important characteristic in and of itself. And I realized that I absolutely agreed with that, and we now know that people who feel more curiosity, more openness to experience, more eagerness for new information, are happier when they're adults. So it's important for two reasons. It makes you a better learner. When you're curious, you're more likely to learn. And it's to the extent that it's a characteristic you hold on to and, you know, sort of embellish as you get older or keep with you, you're likely to live a better life.
Well, if curiosity matters that much, both for learning and for that much broader sense of satisfaction in life, then why has it been so little studied, at least in a frontal way? You know, your book is the first comprehensive study of curiosity, and although you draw on a wealth of data, you're arguing that people have not come at curiosity as this object of study in the way that they should have.
Yeah. Why haven't they?
Yeah.
Okay, let me just start by saying I'll give the good news first. It seems in the last 5 years, there's been kind of a mini explosion of interest in the, you know, in among scientists to understand it, and I'm very happy and excited about that. So that's the good news, that maybe things are turning around. I don't quite know the answer to that, to your question. I have my guesses. One is it's hard to study because curiosity is a feeling, but it's also a behavior. By definition, as a measurement, it has to capture an interaction between a person and an environment, because you're not just curious, you're curious about something. And understanding that something, or the relationship between you, the curious person, and the something you're curious about, that's sort of the nexus. That's the key to understanding curiosity. So it's always about a person-environment interaction, and that's very hard to do. It's also true that curiosity is something people both experience. You know, some of the time you know when you're curious, and some of the time you don't know when you're curious, and certainly babies don't know they're feeling curious. They just act curious. And so that makes it also a little elusive for researchers, sort of deciding, are they going to study it as an experience or as a behavior? Those are some of the reasons. But I also think curiosity, it feels a little dangerous. And there's a reason why, if you think about it in terms of literature and sort of folklore, we have all these phrases, curiosity killed the cat, the most famous story about curiosity, well, the two most famous are Pandora's box, which when she couldn't resist opening it, think of all the terrible things she let out in the world. The last thing she let out of the box was hope. But people get so freaked out by all the first bad things, misery and so forth, they never get to the hope part. And, of course, Eve was curious. And look where that led her.
Both women, and interestingly enough.
So great. I never thought of that. You are right. I once gave a talk called Pandora's Classroom, because, and it was to a group of teachers, because, and it does feel, you know, and curiosity involves risk. So, first of all, when I give workshops and I ask people what they remember being curious about as kids, they almost always tell me about things that were slightly risky. I was curious how far I could swing out on the rope from my tree over the water I was told never to go in. Or, you know, my favorite example of this, I'm going to forget his name, but he writes about finance for the New York Times. When he was a little boy, all he wanted to do was sneak up into the attic and look at his parents' income tax returns. And, of course, the great thing about that is he turned to me and said, doesn't everybody, isn't that what everybody wants to know about? But no, only he, Ron Lieber, only he wanted to know about tax returns. But many people remember wanting to know about slightly forbidden things. I mean, certainly sex is a good example of something that when you're a kid you think you're not supposed to know about, but you really want to know about. And there are other kinds of curiosity that involve risk. And I would say even as we get older, often the things we're curious about, at the very least, there's a risk in exploring the unknown. And from an evolutionary perspective, you know, that makes sense. You know, there's something paradoxical about curiosity because it starts always as an eagerness to know whatever is unknown to you. But part of the reason you want to know it is so it becomes known. You know, so when you look at rats and mazes, they want to explore as a way of making sure that they've got a grip on everything, that nothing unexpected is in the maze or the environment. So I digress here, but curiosity by nature involves a certain amount of risk, and I think that's one reason people have avoided it. It feels a little risky, a little dangerous, and particularly when you're thinking about education. To explore children's appetite for the unknown seems a little dangerous.
And we'll return to that. Susan Engel is my guest. She's a developmental psychologist and author of The Hungry Mind, The Origins of Curiosity in Childhood. The program's Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. So although you write about how curiosity can be fostered, how curiosity can be inhibited, I wanted to ask you about whether people are innately different when it comes to curiosity. If you were to study a number of toddlers, would it be possible to see that irrespective of environment, of parental involvement, that some would be more curious than others, and how, in fact, when you study toddlers, can you strip those things away?
Well, yes. So there are individual differences, and we all know that, right, intuitively. Like, if you think of any five friends of yours, or for people who have siblings, you think of you and your siblings, you tend to vary in how curious you are. And we see that even in toddlers. Whether it's innate or not is a tricky question, because even by the time you're two, you've had some experiences that might shape, you know, your amount or the intensity of your curiosity. For instance, as I said, how the security of your primary attachment and is one example of something that might already have influenced your kind or degree of curiosity. So let's just say there are strong, stable individual differences that seem to start early in life. I mean, I would speculate that some of it is innate, but it's just a speculation, in the same way that to a great extent intelligence, you're born with a certain sort of potential for the ability to learn or take in information. And the environment influences that IQ hugely, but we're not total balls of clay when we're born. We already have some characteristics, and among them, I would guess, is a certain sort of drive or appetite for new information. But as I said, that difference is often then strengthened to some extent or modified by environmental experiences. You know, who you're around, what you have access to, how much it's encouraged, and how much it's modeled by others. All of those are things that can have an impact on how curious you are. So yes, by the time kids get even to preschool, they vary along many dimensions, but one of them is just, you know, how strong their drive is for information. Also, kids vary in how, you know, I said before that kids narrow down their curiosity, so one kid wants to know about bugs and another about, you know, I don't know, fabrics or color or whatever it is, how things work, or conversations. I mean, it cuts across a lot of dimensions. But some people have many things they're curious about. Some kids have a wide range of interests about which they, you know, that they pursue, even informally. And other kids have one or two, and that's it, and they stay very focused on those. And that, too, is an individual difference. So there's sort of overall amount, like drive for information, and then there's how many, sort of how wide the number of types of curiosity a person has. And that, too, is an individual difference.
Has that been tracked over time? Are children who might have a narrow focus versus children whose curiosity is broad end up as adults with those respective types of curiosity?
You know, it's a great question, but to my knowledge, it hasn't been studied. So there hasn't been all that much longitudinal work on curiosity. I mean, as you mentioned before, until recently, the empirical literature on curiosity was very kind of sporadic. There was a flood, you know, a little burst of studies in the early 70s, and then another sort of line of research in the 90s, and only now in the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years has it kind of emerged as a new kind of research again. And we need more longitudinal research. That is, taking a group of kids and studying them, you know, over a number of years. And there are a lot of questions that we might be able to answer with longitudinal data that we haven't been able to answer yet. For instance, we know that things like the expression on a teacher's face or the amount of encouragement you get to ask questions in school, and something we haven't talked yet about at all, which is how rich and complex and nicely ambiguous the environment is, all of which encourages curiosity. We know that those environmental factors can hinder or help a child express curiosity in the moment, but we don't have an answer to the million-dollar question, which is whether having a lot of those good things or very few of those good things when you're, say, 7, 8, 9 has a kind of long-term impact on you into adulthood. That is, for instance, so I teach at a college. When students arrive in my classroom and some seem much more curious than others, is that because of experiences they had when they were 7, 8, 9? And if so, has the window shut, or could I still have an impact on how curious they are? We don't have answers yet to those questions.
Well, you've been talking about the many factors that seem to foster or limit curiosity, and you have also talked about the early school years as being very important. So let's talk a bit more about those years. You mentioned that if teachers are frowning or if they're smiling has some impact on how freely curious children feel. What other factors are at work in schools that might end up having some children get to the end of the elementary school years feeling quite put off about exploring the world?
Yeah, okay, well, I'll talk about three factors. One is, so children, when they're at home, when they're about 2, ask an enormous number of questions. In one study, the typical number of questions was 27 questions per hour. In another study by a different researcher, some kids asked as many as 104 questions per hour. And just for your listeners, that means some toddlers are asking like 2 questions a minute. And for some caregivers or moms or dads out there, they know just what that feels like. You know, why this? What that? What did that happen? Why did that happen? What will we do if we do this? And it's sort of constant, but it's fabulous. When children get to school, when they're like three or four and they go to school, the frequency of questions that they ask drops dramatically, like to four questions per hour. And in my own research, looking at sort of kids in kindergarten and in fifth grade, we would often sit in a classroom and with a videotape, so we were being really careful and objective in the way we were recording those questions, and we would hear as few as two questions per hour, and that's in a room of 23 kids. So that meant lots of kids were asking no questions at all by the time they got to grade school. And questions are, without a doubt, the most powerful form of curiosity we have, because there's a lot you can find out about the world by touching and tasting and banging and pulling apart and watching. And that's true for toddlers, but it's also true for adults. But in the end, the questions here, if you could only have one tool as an explorer, your question would be your best tool. Because you can ask about things you can't see, you can ask about the past, you can ask about sort of for complex explanations. And so if kids aren't getting chances to ask questions because teachers don't have time for it, or they think it's not as important as doing other things, or they want kids to learn certain skills, so asking what they want to know about seems sort of like a detour or a digression, then kids are losing out on a chance to use their best, most intuitive sort of tools for finding out. So that's one thing that happens in school. A second thing, which I alluded to before, is schools often work very hard to make environments very clear and simple, you know, the way the room is set up, the kinds of objects that are available. But curiosity is most often piqued by more complex, dynamic, and variable phenomena. So when we looked in classrooms to see what was making kids curious, the place where they exhibited the most curiosity, well, there were two places now that I think of it. There were places where messy, dynamic things were going on, like fish tanks and aquariums. Fish tanks are aquariums. I mean terrariums. Places where the unexpected was happening and where there was plenty that was unfamiliar. And schools would do well to create more of environments like that. Another good example of this is schools raise all this money to make these beautiful, safe playgrounds, but kids do the most exploration when their play environments are messy or wild or a little, you know, like actual nature is the best, shrubs, trees, moss. And there's actually a fair amount of research that shows that it leads to the most exploration. The other place, the other part of the classroom, I'd never thought of it this way before, but I wish I put this in my book. The other sort of thing in the classroom that elicits the most curiosity from children are other children. And that's because they're messy and dynamic and unpredictable, too. Sure. Who knows what they're going to say or do? And very often, in the interests of teaching skills or keeping order, teachers discourage too much sort of loose, informal interaction between kids. And one thing I do talk about in the book a great deal, I just never cast it that way before, is that children get a tremendous amount of intellectual substance and skills from informal conversations. And when you listen to their informal conversations, you see that they're asking lots of questions and pursuing their curiosity. And when you compare the kinds of question-asking children do at home when they're two to the what happens at school, you see that one reason is at home, you know, there's no script. They're just asking whatever they want to know about. Why ice melts, why the cat goes into a box to poop, you know, every kind of thing. And there's less room in most classrooms for that kind of unscripted question asking, either between adult and child, but also between child and child. So that's a second part of what changes in school is that there's a sort of implicit drive towards simplicity, clarity, and actually that works against curiosity. That would be the second thing. And the third thing is just the focus in school on attaining very particular kinds of information and skills. And, you know, that the sort of highly structured nature of most school environments, which might be necessary for many purposes. I understand that it's an important part of the school experience, but the bottom line is it pushes against curiosity.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of The Hungry Mind, The Origins of Curiosity in Childhood, that's published by Harvard University Press. Susan Engel is a developmental psychologist and educator, and her many books include Real Kids and The End of the Rainbow. So you had been talking about the things within schools, the dynamics within schools, which can discourage curiosity. Are there also assumptions that educators tend to make that can be damaging in terms of how they view curiosity in children?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think one of the assumptions that we all tend to make, and teachers do too, is that curiosity, you either have it or you don't. You know, and so I think most teachers, myself included, as a college teacher, I tend to think this kid is really curious, oh, she's on fire for knowledge, or worse, when I think to myself, oh, he seems kind of incurious, you know, kind of flat intellectually, not hungry for information. And I assume that that's a stable, kind of immovable characteristic. But of course, as with many other characteristics from the teacher's perspective, the best view is this might change, this could change. Actually, it's funny now that I think of it, because teachers often want children's social kind of style to change. I have heard so many teachers over the years say, she's really shy, I wish she'd come out of her shell a little more, he needs to learn how to make friends. And actually, that's really hard to change in a kid. Like, shyness is a pretty stable characteristic. And friend-making style is pretty stable. It's not completely rigid, but it's pretty stable. And yet we always hope kids are going to shift their social style. On the flip side, we tend to assume that their curiosity, they either have it or they don't, you know. And that's not really true. At least the evidence we have so far suggests that it's quite malleable, at least in the short run. So if a kid goes into a room where there's lots of interesting things to touch and look and ask about, or a grown-up who's encouraging that, or I haven't even talked about this, grown-ups who themselves model curiosity, we see a real increase in curiosity on the child's part. And so I don't know if it's damaging, but it certainly doesn't help that we all tend to have these implicit assumptions about, you know, our capacity to encourage or foster curiosity. I mean, look, if I could do one thing to change sort of the role that curiosity plays in the classroom, it would be, you know, my dream come true would be to have a group of teachers in elementary or high school who would say to themselves, no matter what else the kids in my class do this year, they're going to get a little more curious and a little better at pursuing their curiosity. That would be like a dream come true if you had a class that was organized around that goal. But it would mean the teacher would have to assume that that curiosity is something that can change in his or her classroom.
And that it's desirable. I mean, presumably,
yeah,
even very well-meaning teachers often find themselves in a situation where the number of kids to teacher, the ratio, is badly skewed so that there are really not enough adults in the room, and keeping a handle on the classroom, it may be a challenge if you've got lots of children asking all sorts of questions, that compliance might be more attractive than curiosity.
Absolutely. And like we said, I mean, often, you know, so in one of my favorite studies I've ever done with a former student who's now a psychologist herself, we had... So each teacher that came to work with us on this study thought at the time that they were helping us collect data on kids. In fact, they were the subjects in the study, which we later revealed to them, and so they they ended up knowing what we were doing. But when they were in the lab, they thought that they were helping us collect data, and a kid was brought in to the lab to work with them, and they thought they were helping this kid do a science activity with a worksheet. Unbeknownst to them, the kid was our confederate, was working for us, and had been sort of trained to go through the science activity with the grown-up, and at some point unexpectedly put something different in the beaker of liquid than what the worksheet said. And we were very interested in how the adult would respond. But we had two conditions, so there was a twist. In one condition, when we introduced the teacher and the kid to the activity, we said, here's a worksheet, here's some materials, you do the worksheet and you use the materials to do what the worksheet says. And as we left the room, we said, have fun filling out the worksheet. In the other condition, the teachers in that condition with those kids were told, you're going to learn about science. You're going to learn this activity about raisins and liquid. And as we left the room, all we said is, have fun learning about science. And that difference in focus imposed by us made all the difference in the way the adult responded when the kid did the little unexpected thing. They put a Skittle in the beaker instead of a raisin. When teachers felt that they were supposed to be concentrating on finishing the worksheet with the child, they said things like, no, don't do that, or there's no time for that, or it doesn't say that on the worksheet. When they thought their goal was to learn about science, they said things like, oh, that's interesting, what made you think of that? Or, oh, look, I wonder what happened. That tells me that this is not about good teachers or bad teachers. In fact, I would say there are lots and lots of good teachers all over the country who, given the right support, would encourage curiosity. Often it's because they are very attuned to what they are told the goal is by their administration or, in our case, by the researchers. But I think we're a stand-in for, let's say, the superintendent or, you know, federal policy or whatever it is. And the reason I say that is I think compliance for its own sake, sure, that worries teachers. How do I get this group of kids to behave? But often they're getting them to be compliant because they feel they must teach them a certain something. So then the goal is to change what the certain something is that they're trying to teach them. Because if your goal is to get kids to all know these 10 facts, yeah, it's just as well to keep them from asking questions and to keep them from fiddling around with the materials and just get them to learn those 10 facts. If you thought your goal as a teacher, if you were told by your superintendent or your community or your, state, the thing we most want is for the students in your classroom to get to ask a lot of questions and to get a little better at asking questions, that's what compliance would look like then, asking questions.
Yes, and that touches on something that you write about, and I think you've mentioned earlier on, which is one thing that can foster curiosity is ambiguity, is the recognition that there are things that are not known, that may not even be known by the teacher, and that part of the process is exploration and dealing with complexity, which simplistic directives around, testing most obviously, avoids.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very interesting, actually, as you phrased that question, I was thinking about how interesting it would be to explore with teachers their own feelings about uncertainty. Because, there's also some research suggesting that that role models play have an important influence on kids. So if you're around grown-ups who like uncertainty, I was just reading this amazing quote, which I'm now going to use in something I'm writing, from the Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman. So he won the Nobel Prize in behavioral economics, but he's a psychologist. And there's this wonderful new book by Michael Lewis out about his collaboration with Amos Tversky in looking at how people make decisions and judgments. In the book, in Michael Lewis's book, he quotes Kahneman, Daniel Kahneman, describing the wonderful feeling he has when he notes a flaw in his own thinking. I mean, it's the greatest description. And I think it's one of the great luxuries of being a scholar, or in my case, particularly a scientist, which is you love the feeling of not knowing something because it feels good. you know, my youngest son's now getting a doctorate in biology, and he always says to me, Mom, it's not that you love the feeling of not knowing. It's that you love the expectation of knowing something new. And I like that. I like that little twist. But if you think about it, teachers, the place to start all this is in when teachers are getting trained, helping them not only be comfortable with but embrace the feeling of uncertainty. You know, feel a little more the way Daniel Kahneman feels, that it's sort of delicious to think that there's a gap in your knowledge or something you're not quite certain of. And, you know, if you imagine it, like what it feels like when you walk into, I'm imagining a simulated jungle. And I say simulated for good reason, because when people are too afraid, then the unknown seems scary. So walking into a real, if you weren't familiar with the jungle, if you were a person who hadn't grown up in the jungle, walking into a real jungle would be too scary to allow for curiosity. But imagine walking into an environment that feels dense and ambiguous and filled with surprises. That should feel good if you have some sense of safety on the outer edges of it. And why wouldn't you rather explore that? Like, think about going to a zoo. The more enticing exhibit is the one that's more dense and ambiguous. A room that's totally clear and open and has all things that are fairly familiar and sort of easy to see at a glance, well, no kid's going to want to walk in there and explore when they can walk in that other more jungly place. And that's sort of, you know, what you would want teachers to get comfortable with and kids to get comfortable with.
Well, one environment, so to speak, that's dense and ambiguous and complex is the world that is conjured up in reading.
Absolutely.
So what role does reading play or could play in nurturing curiosity?
Such a great way of putting it and such a great question. So, yeah, in my book, I have a whole part on reading. I mean, because the thing about reading, the beauty of reading is that, you know, how I was talking about the jungle, you can enter even very dangerous environments in a book, and you are protected from the ultimate real-world consequences, but you can get a great deal of the ambiguity, the surprise, the unfamiliarity of new experiences. And they might be, you know, to misquote Jerome Bruner, they might be the external landscape, the places that are described in a book. Think about a travel book or an account of a foreign land in a novel. And they might be the internal landscape, people's thoughts, people who are unfamiliar to you or having experiences that are different than the experiences you've had. And the book takes you into those experiences or thoughts. So books are one of the greatest places for satisfying curiosity, and they're perfect because they're not even that risky. I suppose you could argue that books are risky in the sense that they give you dangerous ideas, or they, you know, they whet your appetite for various kinds of real or intellectual, you know, simulated adventure, but they're pretty great in terms of creating every kind of educational ability that we value. They make you more thoughtful. They make you more informed. They always leave some of your questions answered, but more questions to answer with the next, you know, next book. And, I mean, novels, putting nonfiction aside, novels have built into them what curiosity is all about, which is you want to know what's going to happen next, that sense of surprise. I mean, a good novel leads you wanting to turn the page in the same way that when you're curious, you want to, you know, look under the next rock or sure, open the next gadget and see what's inside of it. So reading is essential. And there, too, to go back to your question about school, too often, I think, and I no blame on anybody in particular, it's just sort of the way our whole school system's sort of turned gradually over the last 100 years. Reading does not seem to offer children an adventure or a sense of wading into the unknown or the ambiguous. And that's a shame, because that's exactly what the experience should feel like to kids when they read.
Developmental psychologist Susan Engel is my guest. She's the author of The Hungry Mind, The Origins of Curiosity in Childhood. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, one place where people have historically read has been in their unscheduled free time, whether it's adults, and you do have things to say about how we as adults can nurture our own curiosity. Mm-hmm. But certainly for kids, children tend to have way less unstructured free time than they did in the past. You write in the book about your own childhood and your exploration of the somewhat rural environment that you grew up in, and it sounds like a different world, most of it not structured by adults. That has been a real sea change. How has that affected curiosity?
I think probably badly. And there are two pieces to that, which interests me a lot. One is that in general, you know, more people, I won't speak for everybody all over the country even, but certainly in the middle class, people worry so much about the well-being of their children. So the chance for kids to wander off unsupervised just because of our fear of their safety. You know, I tell a story, I think, in the book about my little niece as a baby wandering around the floor and putting a staple in her mouth. And I describe it as one of those moments of dangerous curiosity. Luckily, I just want everybody to know we got the staple out in time. But it's true that when you let kids explore, they literally can hurt themselves. But I think it's gotten worse. So I hear a lot of parents talking about controlling every aspect of their children's environment, what kind of friends they have, how they spend their free time. And there's this sense, and, you know, I wrote about this in another book called Red Flags or Red Herrings. There's this sense that you could actually determine the person your child is going to be if you can just exert enough good control over every moment of their day. And, of course, it's sort of a hideous wish at the root, because why should we want everyone to be exactly what we want them to be, you know? Luckily, human beings are a little more uncontrollable than that and a little more unexpected in the way they turn out. But so there's this sense that every moment has to be watched over and controlled, and also this sense that to go with that is that they have to always be improving themselves, doing something that's productive, even if it's playing a good game or practicing the right sport or engaging in the right kind of play. Curiosity, I've become, you know, in the new work I'm doing, I've become more and more convinced that, you know, leisure, unscripted, un-goal-directed time, free time, is a friend to intellectual development. And that doesn't mean we should just leave kids alone, because we know that's not true. We know that kids that hear a lot of good conversation and participate in good conversation and have access to interesting experiences, we know that promotes good, you know, all kinds of good things. So I'm not saying neglect your kids and they'll be fine, but there is a great value to having free time, especially if in that free time you have access to interesting places and people and things.
Is there any value in boredom?
Wonderful value in boredom. Another thing we parents increasingly seem to be terrified of letting their children experience. For one thing, sometimes your mind has to be restless or drift or sort of stagnate in order for you to find what it is that interests you, or to trip over the thing that's worth exploring. So, and, you know, this goes for school, too. School is way over-scheduled, and kids are rushing from one thing to another. When curiosity takes time, or the pursuit of curiosity takes time, it doesn't happen quickly. So if we really want kids to not only learn how to identify what interests them and ask the good questions, we also want them to learn how to pursue those questions and maybe get unsatisfactory answers and realize their answers aren't quite satisfactory, and then delve deeper and get a better answer. And, of course, early on, kids do that spontaneously and naturally, which is why they keep asking questions to their mother or father or sister or babysitter or brother until they're satisfied. And they keep changing the way they ask the question when it doesn't quite work right the first time. So the key thing in school is to build on that and formalize it a little bit, but that takes time. So not only is boredom valuable, but so is time to sort of muck around a little bit. And it's not, as I said, that's not the same as saying leave them alone and they'll be fine. It's about thinking about what an educational opportunity or time at home should afford them.
Well, let me end by asking you about how we as adults can nurture curiosity in ourselves, if this is not just something of early childhood, but something that we could expand in ourselves as we age. What would you say? I think you've touched on a number of elements, but pulling them together.
I guess I would start with the exercise of thinking over what you, the person, is curious about. I always start my workshops with educators, asking them what it is they most want to know about. And often they're surprised. They haven't given that much thought in recent years. And so paying a little attention to it, thinking, what is it I do love to know about, I think can help. I think that curiosity is self-perpetuating. So once you experience the pleasure of sort of wading into the unknown and knowing what you didn't know, it's such a good feeling, as Daniel Kahneman said, that you want more of it. So it doesn't take much to ignite it, but maybe in people for whom it's not a very vibrant, dynamic part of their everyday life, what they need to start with is sort of just attending to what is it that piques your curiosity, and how often do you give in to that appetite? It's sort of like stirring up an old appetite.
Susan Engel, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure.
Same here.
Susan Engel teaches in the Department of Psychology at Williams College. She's the author of The Hungry Mind, The Origins of Curiosity in Childhood. That's published by Harvard University Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Her other books include Real Kids and The End of the Rainbow, which I've interviewed her about as well. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.